This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
Lecture 12. Israel in Egypt. In the outline for Exodus is in your notes, and I don't think you have to know that outline. The outline for tomorrow, I think, is Leviticus. Is that correct? But it's a threefold outline: deliverance under Moses, covenant under Moses, worship under Moses. And it really encapsulates the three major events of Exodus: the Exodus itself, the law, and then the tabernacle. Those three things are key to the book of Exodus, and they represent God as present with his people, as Savior and King, as we will see. The theme of Exodus: God establishes his people as a nation by delivering them from bondage through the leadership of Moses and the fulfillment of his promises. Now, Exodus 1 through 18, God delivers his people through his mighty power, not through the power of human effort. Now, what human beings do is important, as we will see, but it's the power of God that delivers his people, as we will see. The first seven verses of Exodus chapter 1 are really introductory and transitional. They look backwards briefly to what has gone before, and they look forward now to the new situation that God's people are facing. Some connections with the past. There's connections with creation. You look at 1:7. The children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. The Eretz was filled with them. You know, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. They increased abundantly. They multiplied. They grew exceedingly. Some of the same terminology. Genesis 1:28 says, fill the earth, fill the Eretz. And here it says, the Eretz was filled with them. So Israel is fulfilling part of that creation mandate as they are multiplying here. There are connections with the patriarchs. Exodus 1:1 through 6, 5 or 6, is a condensed version of a genealogy back in Genesis 46. It reminds us who we're talking about, who are the names of the children of Israel, those who came down into Egypt. And yet there's a transition to a new situation. How many people went down into Egypt? About 70. Now they are a great multitude. They are growing and multiplying in the land. We transition from the children of Israel being a family, the 12 sons of Jacob, to the children of Israel now being referred to not as just a family, but as a nation. They are growing. And so by the time you get down to verse 7, the children of Israel, you're really looking at a fairly large number of people. And, of course, we're moving to when God will make them to be a nation under covenant with him. So we're moving from a family situation to a more nation-type situation. We move, as we've seen, from Joseph and his high standing in Egypt, which helped Israel, now to a Pharaoh, a king who did not know Joseph. And so we move from prosperity of the children of Israel, safety and security, now to bondage, oppression, as we will see. There's also changes in the literary nature of the text. Up until this time, it's mostly been narrative, some other things there, but now there's going to be an interrelationship of narrative and law. When we get to Exodus 20, we'll begin to pick up law. The narrative pace slows down as well. Genesis covered, well, we don't know exactly how many years, depending on where you put creation, I guess. Thousands of years. Exodus to Deuteronomy will center on basically Moses. As we get the birth of Moses here in Exodus chapter 1. So we slow down the pace. And certainly Moses is going to be a central figure in the rest of the Pentateuch. Now, God blesses his people even in the midst of increasing oppression. And there are several things that the Egyptians do here to oppress God's people. The first thing they do is forced labor. Chapter 1, verse 11, talks about how they're going to deal shrewdly with the children of Israel. They're going to set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens and make them do forced labor. What's the result? Verse 12, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. God blesses his people, even in this affliction. There is an interesting or a major term or theme in verses 13 and 14 that comes up periodically as you go through Exodus. The Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with vigor. At the end of verse 14, all their service in which they made them serve was with vigor. The whole concept of service. Who is Israel going to serve? Yahweh or Pharaoh? And that question will be answered. Forced labor doesn't work, so the next thing Pharaoh comes up with is to get rid of the male infants through the midwives. Chapter 1:16, talking to the Hebrew midwives that are mentioned in verse 15, Shiphrah and Puah. Some think that these two midwives may have been the sort of the head midwives, and there may have been other midwives under them. These don't necessarily have to be the only two midwives, but Pharaoh tells them in verse 16, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, you shall kill him. If it is a daughter, she shall live. So the midwives are to get rid of the male children and are to let the daughters live. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? Why have you saved the male children alive? The midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. This may be partly true, but it's probably not the whole truth. This may be a veiled response. Usually questions arise here about whether it is appropriate for the midwives to make this response to Pharaoh. And I would say there are some situations where it is lawful not to disclose the full information to the person who's asking it because of the motivation and intent of the person who's asking it. And I guess a parallel could be if you're in Nazi Germany and you're hiding Jews in your basement and the Nazis knock on your door and they say, do you have Jews in your house? I have no problem with saying no. In times of war, whether that's a declared war there or not, but in times of war, it is appropriate to deceive your enemy. In fact, we leave our house at night, many of us will leave a light on, right? Why? Yeah, that's right. You want somebody to think you're home so they won't break into your house. There's an interesting passage in 1 Samuel 16 where Samuel is to go to anoint David. But Samuel says, if Saul hears me, he will kill me. And so God tells Samuel, take a heifer and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. That's true, but it's not the whole truth. So, my response is there are some situations where I don't think we are obligated to necessarily disclose the whole truth. God does reward the midwives. It was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. So their fear of God, you could argue, led them to save the male babies. And in that context, they gave this response to Pharaoh. And the midwives' names are recorded, which is significant. All posterity reads Exodus and knows who the two midwives are. They are important. They are significant. Now, the third response is Pharaoh now tells all the people at the end of chapter 1, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So now, everybody knows that every son who is born should be cast into the river. And it's this situation in which Moses is born, the deliverer of Israel. He's born in the midst of this oppression and persecution. And there's all kinds of ironies in this section. Moses' mother does, to some, in one degree or another, put Moses in the Nile River, doesn't she? But it's not exactly what Pharaoh had in mind. She places him in an ark that is able to float. A member of Pharaoh's own family sees Moses in the river and undermines Pharaoh's own policy by drawing out this baby and raising this child as a member of Pharaoh's household. Who nurses Moses? His own mother, because the sister is sort of watching what goes on, and when she sees Pharaoh's daughter pull Moses out, she goes up and, shall I find someone to nurse for you? And Moses' own mother gets to nurse her. Now, in those days, you might nurse several years. The significance of this is that Moses would probably have been taught his heritage by his mother. At least later on in this, in chapter 2, Moses is struggling with his heritage in light of what he sees taking place around him. And so I do believe this is significant. It's also ironic that the Egyptians educate the future deliverer of Israel, because Moses goes to school in Egypt. All of the power of the Egyptian government and all the power of Pharaoh, and we're going to talk about the power of Pharaoh a little bit later, can't keep God from working out his purposes. And what a comfort to God's people when we face situations that are very, very difficult. as Israel is facing here. The tension in Moses' life comes out in chapter 12, 11 through 14. The tension between his upbringing and the fact that he knows that the Israelites are his brothers. Notice what chapter 2, 11 through 14 says. It came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. Okay, that's very much emphasized here. He looked this way and that way. When he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. When he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" And then he said, "Who made you a prince and judge over us?" Very important question. Which is going to be answered. "Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Uh-oh. This is known. Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. And Moses had to flee from the face of Pharaoh. And he goes to Midian. He's torn between these two cultures, if you will. He's Jewish. He was nursed by his mother. He knew about his Jewish heritage. These are his brethren, as it says several times in this passage. But he's also Egyptian, to some degree. He was raised as the son of Pharaoh's daughter with all the luxuries and the advantages that would bring. He was educated in all the wisdom of Egypt. He understood Egypt. He understood the way of the Egyptian world and life view. He also understood his Jewish heritage and saw the suffering of his people. And he tries to help his people, but the problem is he tries to help his people through his own effort and ability. He has no calling from God. "Who made you a prince and a judge over us?" Acts 7:25 says he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would have delivered them by his hand, but they did not understand. Moses tries to deliver God's people without divine authorization. He does not have any authority from God. He does not have any call from God. He tries in his own wisdom and strength, and he fails. And so he has to flee. And yet, through his failure, we're going to see God teaches him extremely valuable lessons related to what God has called him to do. How long was he in Midian? Yeah, 40 years. Yeah, 4 years in seminary is not too long, right? He had 40 years training, so... what does he learn in Midian? Well, he has a home and a family. He settles down. And he reflects on his life at the birth and naming of his son. Exodus 2:22. His wife is Zipporah. She bore him a son. He called his name Gershom, which is two Hebrew words brought together that mean stranger there. For he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." It's possible that "there" refers to Egypt. Perhaps he felt like a stranger in Egypt, but now he's found a home as he has settled down. What is Moses' occupation? He tends the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. Where does he tend that flock? In the very wilderness area that he would later lead God's people through. And so just think of the invaluable experience that he obtained these 40 years in getting to know that wilderness and getting to know the area around Mount Sinai. Invaluable experience with that area. And he also learns to wait on God's timing. 40 years is kind of a long time. And he patiently waits. In fact, in chapter 3, the call comes to Moses when he's sort of minding his own business, not even thinking much about what's going on in Egypt. And we're going to see the development here. You go back to 2:14 with that question, who made you a prince and judge over us? That's going to be answered with the call of Moses in chapter 3 with the divine authorization of Moses in chapters 4 and 7. And then finally with the vindication of Moses in chapter 11. Yes, sir. See where we got that 40 years? Let me check it out and come back to it. There's some reason that I have 40 years here, and let me see if I have a note connected to it. I must have read it somewhere, but let me check that out. I'll get back to you on that. Yes, yes.
Moses goes to Midian.
Yes.
Is there anything that connects Midian with the son of Abraham?
I'm not real sure. I don't know if there's any connection between the two or not. If this is just a coincidence, or if there is some connection. Yeah. If there may be, I just don't know. It would be sort of interesting to reflect on that in light of some of the things Reuel says, that the father-in-law says. But I know some of the critical scholars make a lot out of Moses' father-in-law in terms of the origin of the whole Yahweh religion. But that's sort of a little bit different angle. Yes, sir.
What's your read about Gershom meaning stranger in Egypt as opposed to stranger in Midian?
We're not totally certain about it. But if he has settled down, and if he's in Midian for a while, the fact that he has a family and a home, versus the inner turmoil he experienced in Egypt, I think it's, you can draw that conclusion that there could be Egypt, stranger there, in light of the inner turmoil. But you know, otherwise, it's a statement about the fact that he's maybe still a stranger, that he hasn't quite found his home, and maybe there's some truth to that. He hasn't quite found his final. Of course, he really doesn't find his final place because he's with Israel wandering around for so many years. So, let's maybe go on for a little bit longer here. The call comes in chapter 3 as Moses is faithfully carrying out his ordinary duties. And God appears to him in the burning bush, as you know the story. It says in verse 2, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So you have verse 2 talking about the angel of the Lord appearing to him in a flame of fire. And then verse 4 it says, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush. So you've got in verse 2 the angel of the Lord being in the midst of the bush. And then you have in verse 4 just the Lord, and then God called to him from the midst of the bush. This is a very common thing. Yes.
Acts chapter 7, that's where it mentions him being like the wilderness for 40 years.
Okay.
So when they talk about that in Acts 7.
For the wilderness or for Midian?
It says in 729, Athens retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. Now when 40 years had passed, the angel appeared to the wilderness of Mount Sinai.
There you go.
Fire and bush.
Thank you. I have to make a note of that in my...
Acts 7:29.
All right, and do we get a statement of his age earlier? Yeah. Okay. Acts 7:29. Thank you. Back to the burning bush. This is a very common thing that happens when you have the angel of the Lord appear. You have the angel of the Lord, it's the angel of Yahweh, this angel or messenger, you can translate messenger if you wanted to, is separate from Yahweh, but very closely identified with Yahweh or God. And just about every place, or at least some of the key places that this phrase occurs, you have this phenomenon. And you have it right here. So that this angel of Yahweh is closely identified with Yahweh, and some would argue that you can make a case for this being a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, separate but very closely identified with God. Now Moses turns aside to see the bush, and he's told to take off his sandals because where he stands is on holy ground, and God appears to him and identifies himself as the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid himself, for he was afraid to look at God, and God places upon Moses the responsibility, the need to go back to Egypt in order to deliver God's people. And it's at this point that Moses begins to offer a series of excuses. He doesn't want to go back. And his first excuse, let me deal with his first excuse, then we'll take a break. The second excuse is a little bit more in depth. His first excuse comes in 3:11. Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? There's a real emphasis on I in this passage. Who am I? Why should I be the one? Why have you chosen me? Perhaps the failures of the past still haunt him. God's answer in 3:12, I will be with you. It doesn't really matter who you are, Moses. It's my presence with you that's going to make the difference. Now, it's somewhat important that I will be with you. Ehyeh. Ehyeh Imecha. I will be Imecha with you. Ehyeh is going to be a very important word in this passage. But here, God meets Moses' first excuse by telling him, my presence is going to go back with you. So, that's how the first excuse is met. Now, the second excuse gets us into a just a little bit more discussion about Ehya. We come to the second excuse that Moses offers, and it's basically, who are you? I'm not sure he quite said it in that vein. Who are you? But he says in verse 13, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? They're going to ask me, who sent you, Moses? And so what do I tell them? And this is a great passage. God said to Moses, I am who I am. Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Now, I am who I am. Make sure I get this right. Ehya, Asher, Ehya. Ehya is from Haya, which is the verb to be. And it's the first common singular. And we can translate it. It's without getting into too much Hebrew here, we can translate this, I am who I am. We could translate it, I will be who I will be. Or, if we take it as a causative, we could translate it, I create what I create. Now, what does it mean? Well, there are several possibilities. If you stress the causative, I create what I create, which would be the Hebrew hifil, it sort of stresses the absolute sovereignty and control of God. If you translate it, I will be what I will be, the Jewish Study Bible has this note, God's nature will become evident in his actions. So maybe that doesn't specifically answer Moses' question. Most of our translations probably translated, I am who I am, which is a good translation of this, and that may stress, if you take it as an ontological statement about who God is, that may be stressing that he is the eternal one. He is the self-existent one. It's clear in the context that Moses is telling, or God is telling Moses, you can count on me. The issue here is that God will be with Moses. And it's possible all three of, and I would either go with number one or number three, I guess. But the point here is God sending Moses back to Egypt, and that God is going to deliver his people out of Egypt. And God has the power to accomplish this. Now, a derivative of this name is found in Exodus 3:15, and we've run across this name for God already, the name Yahweh. Both Ehya and Yahweh are related to the verb to be, Hayah. The Y on Yahweh, a yod in Hebrew is usually third masculine singular, and this is first common singular. So both of these are related to the Hebrew verb hayah, to be, and we've already talked about the significance and the meaning of the name of Yahweh, and we're going to find out more about the name and the meaning of Yahweh as we go through the plagues. This is foundational in many ways for things we run across later. This is foundational for our understanding of who Jesus is. Do you know how the Septuagint translates? Ego, eimi. There's also a very interesting Hebrew phrase. I'll throw this into the mix. You have two Hebrew pronouns, ani, which means I, and the Hebrew who, which means he. And you have in Isaiah the phrase, ani hu, I am he. And I have passages listed for you. In fact, one of them occurs in Deuteronomy 32. But several of these come from Isaiah. For example, Isaiah 41:4, I, Yahweh, am the first and the last. I am he. Ani hu. Isaiah 48:12, I am he, ani hu. I am the first and I am the last. And guess how the Septuagint translates this phrase. Ego eimi. And so you come over to John 8. And Jesus says, you will die in your sins if you do not believe. Ego eimi. Translated by some translations, I am he. Which certainly has connections to Exodus 3 and to Isaiah 41, ani hu. And several times in John chapter 8, when you lift up the Son of Man, you will know. Ego eimi. And then the one that really shatters their ideas when he says in John 8:58, before Abraham was, ego eimi. And they pick up stones to stone him because he's now identified himself with Yahweh. So Exodus 3 and then this other phrase here from Isaiah are very foundational for these things that Jesus says about himself. He claims to be Yahweh. Now there's also an interesting text related to the name Yahweh in Exodus chapter 6, verse 3. God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai. I'm sure you've heard that name for God. But by my name, Yahweh, I was not known to them. Now that's an interesting statement because if you read through the patriarchal information, you have Abraham and others using the name Yahweh to refer to God. So what does it mean that I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but by my name Yahweh, I was not known to them? Well, the point is not just knowing the name, that it's Yahweh is a name that we call God. The point is the meaning or the significance of the name. The children of Israel are not going to know the full redemptive significance of the name Yahweh until the Exodus event. Well, they will come to know Yahweh as the covenant name of God, the God who delivers his people, the God who redeems his people, the God who is a divine warrior who fights on behalf of his people and wins all of the victories for God's people, that they will come to understand through the Exodus event. Now, there's a few other excuses here by Moses. His third excuse, what if they will not believe me or listen to my voice? Chapter 4, verse 1. The issue of belief and trust is a fairly dominant theme in chapter 4. God responds by giving Moses three signs. A staff changed to a snake, and that's very significant. We'll talk about that a little bit later in Moses and Aaron's confrontation with Pharaoh. A leprous hand is another sign that God gives to Moses, which specifies God's authority over sickness and disease. And then water turned to blood may not have been performed here, but it may represent the onslaught of the plagues, which is the first plague that Moses is going to, God is going to send. Moses also claims to be slow of speech in chapter 4, verse 10. And God keeps reinforcing the adequacy of his presence. And finally, Moses just basically says, I don't want to go. 4:14. 13. You know, Lord, please. Send by the hand of whomever else you may send. And now God gets angry and provides for Moses Aaron as a spokesperson. So Aaron now is given to Moses to help him in this job that God has called him to do. Now Moses begins to act in obedience to God. Obedience brings success. He goes back home. He takes the necessary steps to begin to do what God wants him to do. And yet, out of nowhere, comes this passage in chapter 4, verses 24 to 26. We're not ready for this. Let me begin by reading verse 22 because that does set a little bit of context that is important for this passage. 4:22, you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed I will kill your son, your firstborn. That's what Moses is to tell Pharaoh. Now, verse 24, it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at, my translation says Moses' feet, but Moses is in italics, so that's debatable as we're going to see. And said, surely you are a husband of blood to me. So he let him go. Apparently he being Yahweh. Then she said, you are a husband of blood because of the circumcision. Something's going on here. And it seemed to have something to do with circumcision. But there's a lot of confusion in this passage. Who do the pronouns refer to? Is this referring to Moses? Is this referring to his son? What's the motive for God's attack? And what do we make of Zipporah's remarks? Well, this passage centers around circumcision. That seems to be the problem. What would be the problem if Moses' child is not circumcised? Why would that be problematic? Yeah, Genesis 17, right? What happens to those who are not circumcised as a part of the covenant community? They're cut off. And Moses, as being a leader of God's people, should have had his son circumcised. He's now being sent back to Egypt to deliver God's people, and there's a problem because his son is not circumcised. Okay, we know that much for sure, that circumcision is the issue here. The rest of it is nebulous, but I think we can make sense out of it. Verses 22 and 23 talk about firstborn. Israel is my son, my firstborn. Therefore you say to Pharaoh, let my son go. If you don't, I will kill your firstborn. I think because of the context and because of the issue of circumcision, we should read verse 24, it came to pass on the way at the encampment that Yahweh met him, the firstborn of Moses, and sought to kill him. He has not been circumcised. He is in danger of being cut off from the covenant community. And the context here of the firstborn in verses 22 through 23 would lead naturally then for us to think of Moses' child being in view in verse 24. So, Zipporah takes a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son. And now the rest of the verse we're going to have to talk about. My translation says, cast it at Moses' feet. The verb cast here is the same verb that's going to be used later for placing the blood on the doorpost during Passover. I'm trying to see if I've got the... I wrote that down. But it is the same verb. The word feet is the Hebrew regel, which is a slippery term in Hebrew. It can mean leg, it can mean feet, it can even be a euphemism for the sexual organs. The phrase husband of blood does not have to be translated as husband, but can refer to a family member. The term for husband there, husband of blood. The way I would read this is Zipporah took a sharp stone, cut off the foreskin of her son, and dabbed it, threw it on his leg. She cuts off the foreskin and dabs it. It's like they put the blood, dabs it on the leg of her son. And says to him, you are a family of blood to me. You see, the problem with the son is he's not circumcised. He's not under the protection of the covenant. And it's the circumcision that brings him under the protection of the covenant. And there may be a parallel here, a foreshadowing of the Passover, where the blood of the lamb is dabbed or thrown on the doorpost, which meant that those who were in the house were protected by the blood. There may be a parallel here that now this child is protected, having been circumcised. This child is now a family member of blood, a part of God's covenant community. Now, to me, that's the best explanation I've read of these verses. And it's reinforcing the importance of circumcision as a sign of the covenant, and that now Moses' firstborn son is circumcised. Now, why Zipporah does it and Moses doesn't do it, I'm not sure the answer to that question. Why Moses did not circumcise his son before this, I'm not sure the answer to that question. But as a leader of God's people, Moses needs to be faithful in this covenantal sign in his own family. Well, having navigated that, The rest of the chapter goes very smoothly. Everything else in this chapter really works out very well. Moses goes back, and if you look at verse 29, Moses and Aaron gathered all the elders of the children of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He did the signs in the sight of the people. The people believed. And when they heard that Yahweh had visited the children of Israel and that he looked on their afflictions, they bowed their heads in worship. Tremendous response. Certainly a response that you'd want to have if you were Moses going back after so many years to try to bring God's people out of Egypt. Yes, sir. It's the proper response. If they would have kept this response throughout the wilderness, things may have turned out differently. But so initially, they respond in a good way. Yes, sir. Yes, thank you. That's correct. I had changed that in mind, but that is correct. At the end of this lecture, it's chapter 429, 430, and 431 rather than in chapter 5. Thank you for that.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.